Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy Monday. Beautiful start to the week. It's things are slowing down a little bit as the summer goes on, but they're not slowing down over at the White House. It's just whack away at those constitutional rights. Let's see what we can dismantle this week. Let's see what we can, on and on it goes. It's rather surprising with Mr. Gonzalez. The debate, did he lie to the Senate, or was this actually possibly even a very carefully set up gotcha? It's interesting speculation. We'll be getting into that as we go on through the program. But right now, Richard Viguerie is with us. Richard Viguerie, one of the grand old men of the grand old party, or at least of the American modern conservative movement. His book, Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. He's also a co-founder of the American Freedom Agenda, along with Bruce Fein, Bob Barr, David Keene. Bruce Fein and Bob Barr both have been on this program in the last week and a half. Richard Viguerie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
Thank you. Good to have you back. A couple of things I wanted to talk with you about. One of them being the American Freedom Agenda and this administration, and the second being the Republican Party and your concern about it. And I guess the third in that context, Fred Thompson. You've been editorializing about Fred Thompson recently and your concerns about him. It's hard to tell whether he's really a serious Republican candidate or not, but there's a lot of buzz around him right now.
Well, I think he's planning on being a serious candidate, primarily because there's such a vacuum out there, Tom, among the base of the Republican Party, the people who are right of center politically and ideologically, and just nobody at the top tier that, quite frankly, has a serious chance of being elected president, is ringing conservatives' bell. They're just a vacuum there. Unfortunately, conservatives feel that there's just no obvious heir apparent to Ronald Reagan, so we keep looking for Ronald Reagan, and clearly that person is not on the horizon at this time.
But Fred Thompson's sort of a Rorschach test at this point, isn't he? I mean, people see in him what they want to see, even though for 20 years he was a lobbyist. I mean, nobody even talks about that. That was his major career contribution.
Well, in this article that I put out that you referenced, he's very much clearly a Washington insider and, a lobbyist. And the only distinction he has when he was in the Senate for 8 years is basically being a key mover and shaker behind the McCain-Feingold legislation, which is an anathema to conservatives. So there's very little in his background that really endears him to conservatives. So I suspect he'll come on the scene sometime in the next few months and probably not go very far and still leave a vacuum. And at some point, I think we'll see Newt Gingrich probably come into the race, simply because there's still going to be that vacuum that conservatives are looking for to someone fill the Ronald Reagan role.
Do you think that the conservatives, the old line conservatives, people that whose point of view you're representing within the Republican Party, are still strong enough in the Republican Party that they could bring forward somebody like Newt Gingrich as a candidate, as a serious candidate for president in 2008? Or do you think that the party is leaving behind conservatives and they're going to go for somebody who's more centrist? Mitt Romney, for example, who just, a couple of years ago was all pro-choice and now he's all, pro-life, that sort of thing.
I think it shows the strength of the conservatives that most all the candidates are trying to make nice with the conservatives. Certainly the conservatives are the base of the party. If they don't have the conservatives as the base, there is no meaningful Republican Party. But Newt also is not seen as the heir to Ronald Reagan. He's a Washington insider, the same as Thompson and most of these other top-tier candidates. And he's not seen by conservatives as a reincarnation of Ronald Reagan. Now, he's not a liberal, but you know, he's a Washington politician. They can kind of play it any way you want to play it. I had an epiphany, by the way, about 2-3 months ago. I was reading a wonderful book by a friend of mine, Bill Mittendorf. He wrote a book called A Glorious Disaster, which is an insider's look at the draft Goldwater movement. And Bill Mittendorf was there. In fact, he was a treasurer of the draft Goldwater movement. And he wrote this wonderful book, behind the scenes look at the whole effort to launch Goldwater on the national stage and to...
This in 63 or in 59?
Beg pardon?
Was this in 63 or in 59, 60?
Well, it started early, I'd say, in 61, probably 62, and that's when Bill was involved. And the whole, I came to Young Americans for Freedom as the executive secretary in the summer of 1961 in New York, and that was really the beginning of the draft Goldwater excitement, energy, and passion. But I read the first page of the book, and I put it down, and I began to think that, and I feel like the Lord took a scales off my eyes, and I could see clearly for at least 15, 20, maybe more years, Tom, every conservative I know has been looking for Ronald Reagan. Is he around that corner over there? Maybe he's behind that door, down the street, whatever. You know, we just keep looking for Ronald Reagan. And it occurred to me, that's wrong. We should not be looking for Ronald Reagan. We should be looking for Barry Goldwater. Because it was Barry Goldwater who, when he announced in January of 1964, he knew he would never be president of the United States. But he launched his campaign for one simple reason, which was to launch the conservative movement. And he did. And you can draw a straight line from Goldwater's race for the presidency in 63, 64, to Ronald Reagan's election to governor in 66 and the, you know, take off.
Yeah. No, and I remember the energy around that. I mean, I was 13 years old in 64. My dad was in the county Republican Party, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. Within 3 years, I was absolutely on the other side. But nonetheless, I remember those times. And I've always been mystified by why conservatives are so enamored of Ronald Reagan. Here's a guy who ran up more debt than every other president in the history of the United States combined, who presided over an incredible bloating of the federal government, who had more senior officials of his administration convicted of crimes, serious crimes, and sent to prison than any other president in the history of the United States, arguably the most scandal-ridden presidency in the United States. I don't see what he accomplished. What was conservative about him other than his rhetoric?
You know, what did he buy with the debt? What he bought, Tom, was the end of the Soviet Union, the evil empire. The world was...
Well, the CIA was predicting that in 1970. Well, back in the 70s, the CIA was saying that the Soviet Union had less than 20 years to go. Gorbachev himself has come out and said, we knew this thing was falling apart. This had nothing to do with Ronald Reagan.
Well, that may be so. The socialist in the left, Gorbachev, etc., likes to think that, Ronald Reagan didn't have anything to do with it. Gorbachev didn't have anything to do with it. Well, he did. And this thing had been predicted to collapse for 75 years, and it was Ronald Reagan who, through building up before we can build down, how right he was. He also was right in another way. He said we weren't going to defeat the Soviet Union so much as we were going to transcend it. We were going to go around it, over it, under. And that's what happened. No planes flew, no armies marched, no tanks rolled, and we woke up one day and the Soviet Union had gone away. Contrast that, Tom, with this president who campaigned in 1999, 2000 against nation building, and he has become the biggest nation building president in American history. And Ronald Reagan won the Cold War by bankrupting the Soviet Union. I'm afraid this president could bankrupt America and lose the war.
So George W. Bush, clearly no Ronald Reagan. Bruce Fine on this program a week and a half ago called for the impeachment of both George Bush and Dick Cheney for crimes against the Constitution. And Bob Barr called for an investigation into that. Are you, as part of the American Freedom Agenda, of a similar mind, Bruce Fine?
No, I don't think it's appropriate to think in terms of impeachment. I think that, we need to, alert the American people and educate them, inform them at how this administration has seriously abused the rights and privileges afforded them and accorded to them under the Constitution. And every president tries to get more power than they're supposed to have. It's kind of natural.
But if Bill Clinton had done these things, wouldn't you, wouldn't Wouldn't you have wanted to impeach Bill Clinton if he had done these things that, that George W. Bush is doing?
No, I don't think, who knows? You know, I wasn't, that didn't happen at the time, and so, you know, who knows what you would have done in
the first place. If you can stick around over the break... Richard Vigory, can you stick around over the break here?
Absolutely, be likely.
I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, what happens if Hillary becomes president and she has the powers that George Bush has taken onto himself, and what's the future of the conservative movement in the United States and the Republican Party. 16 minutes after the hour, talking to Richard Vigory, author of Conservatives Betrayed. Tom Hartman here with you.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Let's be the good guys again. We're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
So the 10 points of the pledge of the American Freedom Agenda are no military commissions except on the battlefield, no evidence extracted by torture or coercion, no detaining citizens as unlawful enemy combatants, restore habeas corpus for suspected alien enemy combatants, prohibiting warrantless spying by the National Security Agency in violation of the law, renouncing presidential signing statements, ending secret government by invoking state secrets privilege, stopping extraordinary renditions, stop threats to prosecute journalists under the Espionage Act, and end the list of individuals or organizations defined as terrorists based on secret evidence. This, the pledge put forward by Bruce Fein, Bob Barr, David Keene, and Richard Vigory, the American Freedom Agenda. Richard Vigory is with us. And Richard Vigory, also author of Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. Mitt Romney refused to sign this thing, and you said that he was unfit to serve as president. George Bush is the embodiment of the antithesis of this.
And I think he's unfit to serve as president, as I put forth in my book that you just referred to, Conservatives Betrayed. You know, he lied to the conservatives, which means he lied to America to become president. And he's been a disaster. He may go down in history as one of the worst, if not the worst, American president.
Then how do we hold him to account?
Well,
and how do we, and even, perhaps even more importantly, how do we make sure that the next president, and you know, for purposes of making you shudder, let's imagine that it's Hillary Clinton, doesn't have these same powers?
Oh, well, unfortunately, he's set a precedent, and that's why it's so dangerous, what he's done. I think that, you know, this needs to become part of the political debate, Tom. I think everybody, whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, moderate, liberal, you should be concerned about this, because, you know, time goes on. There'll be some Republicans elected, some Democrats. So it won't always be our own person, so to speak.
Right.
And everybody should be worried about the abuse of power. Congress has basically just kind of rolled over here for some years and let the president run amok in too many areas. And
but here we have, you know, attempts by the Democrats in Congress to change some of these things, and Republicans filibustering them in the Senate. I don't see any... It seems to me that we are already in a constitutional crisis, and if Congress is being blocked by the Bush administration and the loyalty of them by Republicans in the Senate from doing things about this, what other remedy is there than impeachment?
Well, I think that's pretty that sounds to me like a political solution to the problem. I'm not sure it is.
But it's a political problem, isn't it?
Well, in some ways, but you said it's a constitutional crisis, and
right.
Tom Jefferson said, let no more be heard about the goodness of man by tying down by the change of the Constitution, and we Americans only give up their freedoms, basically in time of crisis, and you referred to crises, and that's, I'm afraid, that whether a Republican is president or Democrat, people, whether it's health care or war against terrorism, that they're going to feel that we have to give up freedoms. And we're heading into a very, very dangerous time where all of our freedoms are being eroded, and I think it's going to happen whether Republicans in office or a Democrat.
Yeah, I would say we're not heading there. We've been there for the last 4 or 5 years.
And that's why you're seeing such interesting coalitions come together. American Freedom Agenda, we've been talking to a lot of people on the left about joining here, and you've got Bob Boer, the ACLU, a lot of other people come together in interesting coalitions here because we are losing our freedoms rapidly.
Yeah, you and I mean, you know, we could have probably a loud and vigorous disagreement about, for example, national health care or, you know, what you would call big government, what I would call the we society or whatever. But on these issues of the absolute civil rights of Americans, this stuff came about when this country did not have political parties.
Yep, absolutely.
This transcends political parties.
You had said before the break there, what's the future of the conservative movement? The few minutes left to us here, let me just say that I think what conservatives need to do is think in terms of a third force, Tom, not a third party, but a third force. The left has been enormously successful with third force. They have the environmental groups out there, the consumer groups, the civil rights groups, the unions, and all of these have their own agenda, their own membership, their own source of funds, and they pull everybody in politics their direction. And I think conservatives have made a lot of mistakes. Number one, perhaps above everything else, they became an appendage of the Republican Party. They just got far too close to the Republican Party. We need to, sue for divorce and focus on our own issues, our own agendas. And we're not going to come to power in 18 months. It's just not going to happen. Even if I were able to select the next president, we wouldn't have a conservative House, Senate, governors, legislators. So conservatives are going to have to go back and, you know, spend a lot of hard years working to relaunch the conservative movement.
Could that be, Richard Viguerie, because America isn't where you guys are at?
Nope. It means because, like my book, Conservatives Betrayed, we were lied to. George Bush and other big government Republicans lied to the country, and they said they were something that they weren't. And his father did the same thing. His father said, I am a conservative. Trust me, if I become president, I will govern as a conservative. Well, he lied to us. He didn't govern as a conservative. They can't get elected on their own views and values, so they have to lie to the voters.
Yeah, interesting. So, Richard Viguerie is the author of Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. Richard Viguerie, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Days, 12 hours, 20 minutes, 20 seconds, until George W. Bush voluntarily surrenders the White House. We'll see if it happens a little before that, if we can get enough folks involved in the impeachment movement. By the way, I'll be on the road for Leonardo DiCaprio's new feature-length documentary, his new movie, The 11th Hour. I'll be at several of the openings. The dates have been announced, but the time and theaters have not been, so when we know, we'll post it over at TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. But on the 17th of August, Friday the 17th of August, I'll be live broadcasting from our affiliate in Los Angeles, K-Talk, and I will be at a theater in the Los Angeles area that evening where the 11th Hour, Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, will be showing. I'm in the movie, by the way, and I will be doing a Q&A afterwards. On the 20th, on Monday, I'll be in New York City for a local showing, and we'll be broadcasting live from New York City on that day, and also all of next week, by the way. And on the 24th, I'll be live from the Quake, our San Francisco affiliate. And the evening of the 24th of August, I'll be at a opening of the 11th Hour, a showing of the 11th Hour. And that time and theater also to be announced. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. The telephone number for Congress, let us never forget, 202-225-3121. You want to drop into our blog, TomHartman.com, or AirAmerica.com is where our active blog is right now. If you go to the Tom Hartman page and participate in that, it actually says Louise Hartman's blog. It's the posts for the day. And our message board and chat room, there are links to it from AirAmerica.com and also over at TomHartman.com. Jerry in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in central Pennsylvania here where Jim Carville describes us as you got Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and in between you got Alabama.
Oh, really?
I've been listening to you on Sirius for the last couple of years. The first time I got a chance to call, the fellow you had on a while ago, your guest, and with Bruce Fein, these good conservatives, now that there's only a year and a half to go in Bush's administration, they come out like good capitalists that they are, pushing their books. Where were they a couple of years ago before the election? They're smart gentlemen. They know what's going on.
Well, this is the thing that one of my policies is not to trash my guests when they're not around to defend themselves. And so I don't want to speak specifically to Richard Viguerie. And frankly, I think that he's a relatively principled conservative. That would be a good question to put to him or any of these other guys. You know, where were you 3 years ago? This was not a surprise. But the thing that I find interesting is, you know, it's really easy to go out there and find Democrats who are going to call for the impeachment of Bush. I mean, throw a penny into a crowd and bang, you've got one.
What I want to do
is try and get as many conservatives on this program as I can who are pushing back against this administration, because we're not hearing their voices. They're not being heard in the mainstream media. They're being by and large locked out. They're not being heard in the conservative media because the conservative media is marching lockstep with the Bush administration. And they're not being heard in the liberal media because the liberal media generally doesn't talk to conservatives. And I think it's really important that people realize that there is a kind of bicultural consensus emerging. Both sides, the old line liberals and progressives like myself and old line conservatives like Richard Viguerie, who are looking at the presidency of George W. Bush and saying, yes, this really and truly is the worst presidency in the history of the United States. And people like Bruce Fein and Paul Craig Roberts saying, and we should throw the guy out of office. We should impeach him. Not just because he's done terrible things, but because he has set a precedent. He has torn our Constitution asunder. He's ripped it into shreds, and it's a horrible thing for American democracy. Jerry, thank you for the call and for the point. I think it's well made. John in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I've got a brother who's a neocon. We sometimes disagree, as you might imagine. And one of his old talking points is, well, you know, you cut taxes and you generate more activity in the economy and more sales and tax revenue and so forth. And I've challenged him over the time on that. But he did send me something that says that at least for the month of April, our tax revenues hit an all-time high, which he attributes to the tax cuts, and I disagree with that. And I thought I'd get your take on it, Tom. I mean, it's the article says here, you know, tax revenues was $1.5 trillion and increased 11.2% over the same period last year.
No, it's true. There's two main reasons why the U.S. tax revenues are at an all-time high, John, and they're really simple when you think about it for a second. The first is that inflation cranks everything up by 3% every year, more or less, and some years more than that. And so, you know, over time, you're going to see increased tax revenue simply because taxes are indexed and inflation goes up and so the value of the dollar goes down. And so you have more taxes. And the second is that the economy has been growing, not so much. I mean, it's been growing at half the speed it was growing under Clinton, and not so much as the result of any exogenous factor, external factors, or even internal factors, like whether or not there's tax cuts or whether businesses are getting more efficient or anything. But the economy is growing because the population is growing.
Right.
Our population is growing rather dramatically in the United States. And, I mean, you know, we're at or over 300 million people right now. When Kennedy was sworn into office, I think we were in the neighborhood of 200 million. We've really grown dramatically. We were only around 100 million when Franklin Roosevelt came into office.
And so
you look at the size of, you know, at that, and you can just throw out of the window, you know, anything about, oh, it had to do with tax cuts. And that's nonsense.
Well, what I'd love to see is some kind of, or actually, an examination where those things are taken into account. As you say, the inflation rate and the rate of growth of the economy, the number of people. I'd love to just have it debunked once and for all. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because he throws it something from the AP wire and it's just too easy.
I know. Let me poke around, John. Maybe there's a website out there that has done a good job of it, and if so, we'll see if we can track it down, and I'll put it up on our website, and I'm post over on our message board and put it on the blog at airamerica.com. But, you know, my rebuttal to him would just be, I mean, those three points and just say, hey, you know, here's some common sense stuff for you. You know, whether you have tax, why is it that when Franklin Roosevelt raised the top marginal tax rate from around, what, 14, 16%, something like that, whatever it was, before World War II, up to 91%, we saw an increase in tax revenues too. I mean, why is it that when Bill Clinton raised taxes from Reagan's 27 or 29% up to 36 or 38%, I forget the exact numbers, we saw an increase in tax revenue. It's like no matter what you do, you're going to see an increase in tax revenue as long as your population is increasing, as long as you have inflation, and as long as your economy is expanding.
Well, by his logic, if we decreased taxes to zero, the federal coffers would be overflowing.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the absurdity of it. I mean, you know, he's making the old mashed potatoes equals murder equation. You know, 100% of all mass murderers ate mashed potatoes at one point in their lives. Therefore, we should ban mashed potatoes because eating mashed potatoes creates mass murder. I mean, you know, it's that kind of absurd logic. John, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Bob in Westport, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the call. I'm a independent. I live my life conservatively, and what drives me nuts is that we're still borrowing $12,000 million a month for this war rather than paying for it like we did during Vietnam. And people go around.
We actually borrowed, just to set the record straight, Bob, we borrowed massively to fund Vietnam. It was one of the problems that later hit both Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and Gerry Ford. It really hit Ford and Carter the hardest, was that those treasuries were coming back in. And it was depressing the economy. I mean, that what you were seeing in the Ford and Carter years and the first couple of years of the Reagan administration, for that matter, you know, the Reagan recession, was the wringing out of the economy of the borrowing on the one hand, number one, and number two, on the enormous military spending that produces no long-term effect. In other words, you build bombs, you build bullets, you build tanks, they get blown up, and they don't generate any more economic activity. You build bridges, you build schools, you build hospitals, the same exact number of dollars, and they generate economic activity for decades, maybe centuries.
There's no disagreement there. What I'm saying is that our country isn't being run conservatively by the conservatives, it's being run fascistly, and we're not paying for what we're buying, and so we're not the richest nation in the country. We're going down the tubes, and we, the people, aren't even being told the truth about how deeply in debt we are and what's going to happen and how are we going to pay this debt off. Meanwhile, we're hiring mercenaries to do our fighting. I think the people who think they're conservatives and are blindly backing this president, and that includes all our members of Congress and the Senate, are not conservatives if they're voting the way that this guy's telling them to march, you know, vote in lockstep with George Bush.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And Henry Wallace, in fact, the third vice president under Franklin Roosevelt, you know, made that point that what we're seeing are the American fascists now, and they were rearing their ugly heads in the 30s and 40s, and they're back full blown. You're absolutely right, Bob. Well said. Thank you very much. It's amazing. Ken in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Ken, got about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. A quick one?
I won't waste your time enumerating all the high crimes and misdemeanors of which this administration is responsible, but I have a problem with the intellectual dishonesty of the otherwise smart callers and people who have a problem with impeachment because politically they don't want to tie up the system or they see it might bog us down. What kind of, even so-called Democrats or liberals who feel that way, what is their fear?
I know it's an irrational statement, and they say, "Oh, well, it's all about politics." Well, I'm sorry, politics is what this country was founded on. Politics is what runs the government. Yes, politics is a good word, not a bad word. You know, at least in many contexts.
So Clinton's impeachment wasn't political?
Well, Clinton's impeachment was partisan, and that's a different thing. Something being political has to do with the political process. That's how we pass laws.
Thank you.
I know. You're absolutely right. Good point, Ken. Excellent point. Republicans conflate the two, and we need to make a separation. The political process is a healthy process. It's called democracy. The partisan process, particularly Karl Rove's idea of a permanent Republican majority that lasts for 100 years, that's like Hitler's thousands of years of peace. I mean, that's partisan, and it's wrong. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
flags are all displayed, and the Empire stole old glory for a beer made parade. Remember Patrick Tillman, the men he liked and wars he made, and hell has no fury like patriot betrayed.
Yes, remember Patrick Tillman. And increasingly, we are. And as the word comes out that the Bush administration has hid something up, covered something up, and George W. Bush invoking executive privilege, a right that the Supreme Court basically carved into the Constitution. It doesn't exist in the Constitution. The Supreme Court created this right of presidents and very narrowly circumscribed it to discussions in the White House that have to do with foreign policy. And matters of national security, and how Patrick Tillman's death would directly influence the foreign policy or national security of the United States is something that most of us just don't get. Why should Bush be able to cover up what he knew about that? It's just bizarre. Anyhow.
Maybe I'm crazy.
Maybe we all are. I don't know. Maybe the folks in Hollywood are. Here's why. Hollywood residents believe they've found a humane way to reduce the out-of-control neighborhood pigeon population and the mess that comes with it. Over the next few months, a birth control product called OvoControl P, which interferes with egg development, will be placed in bird food in new rooftop feeders. Hollywood trying to do something about pigeons. I would submit to you that what has happened, really, this is just a conspiracy. What has happened, really, is that ever since we started talking about it on this program 4 or 5 years ago, people are figuring out that pigeons are actually robots from the planet Xenu who are dropped down here by the mothership every 6 months and spy on us. That's why whenever there's a major collection, convention, meeting of world leaders, you see thousands and thousands of pigeons. It's why there's pigeons near my house. They're listening in. And then the mothership comes and picks them up and drops a new load and rewinds the tapes and gets all the information. And that's why you've never seen baby pigeons and you've never seen dead pigeons, because they're robots, right? So the people in Hollywood are just trying to convince us that pigeons are actually real when we all know that they're not. You know I'm kidding you, right? Joe in Orinda, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'm calling because I'm just so frustrated. I know Congress is doing a lot of things that are great, but, you know, I really don't feel like they take this guy seriously. I mean, this guy has got, if you read David Lindorf's article in commondreams.org about this martial law stuff, I mean, the gun is loaded. Yeah. All they're waiting for is a pretext. I don't think
he has any intention
of ever giving up power, which is why he's going for this unitary executive stuff.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that piece on commondreams.org was brilliant this morning. In fact, I have it printed out, and it's in my stack of stuff to talk about today. And the point that he's making is that Bush has put into place all the things necessary to implement martial law in the United States. And frankly, and I don't recall if he gets into it, the piece or not, I think not, but in my opinion, he frankly tested it in New Orleans. And not just martial law, but mercenary martial law, and bringing in the Blackwater guys down there, and it's just where is Congress? Why aren't they saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a bridge too far? What would happen? How different would the world have been if in 1934 the German Parliament had said, wait a minute, Hitler wants to do what? And he wants what powers? You know, when they passed the Enabling Acts, actually, I think that was 33, late 33. And if the German Parliament had said, no, we're going to push back on this, and in fact, we're going to even impeach or remove this guy from office because he's pushing too hard in a direction we don't want to go. Think how different the world would be. And I'm very concerned. I share your concern, Joe, and I thank you for your call. You're right. He has a loaded gun, and with the executive authority. Patrick in San Diego. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you. Richard Viguerie drives me nuts because he's such a honk for Ronald Reagan. Well, one of his comments, and I call it the biggest Republican lie, is that Ronald Reagan brought down the Soviet Union.
Osama bin Laden, by the way, makes the same claim, that he brought down the Soviet Union.
Who does?
Osama bin Laden. Oh. He says that he bled them dry in Afghanistan.
Hey,
I think Jimmy
there's
Carter,
probably some truth to that.
I think Jimmy Carter has as much of a claim on it because in 1978, I was watching Good Morning America, and they were interviewing Daniel Ortega right after the Sandinistas had brought down the Somoza government in Nicaragua. And they asked him if he was expecting any help from the Soviet Union. And Daniel Ortega said, the Soviet Union is bankrupt. They cannot help us. They can barely feed themselves. We're on our own. And it was at that point that I realized the Cold War was over. The Soviet Union was bankrupt.
Well, I can tell you, having been in both East Germany and in Moscow, when the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union and East Germany was East Germany, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s, it was an open secret. I mean, anybody who ever traveled into those countries knew that these systems were collapsing, that the rot was so bad. I mean, I remember staying at the Aeroflot Hotel, the only place where foreigners could stay, and I was on the third floor, and the elevator didn't stop on the third floor because it was broken. And so we had to take the elevator up to the fourth floor and walk down when we went up, and we had to walk down to the second floor to grab the elevator to the ground floor when we walked out, or when we were leaving. It was just, and you just look around and nothing's working, nobody was working, nothing was happening. It was, and in the 70s, the CIA was predicting that within a decade or two, the Soviet Union would collapse or transform. In fact, they were very concerned about it because they thought that it would lead to international instability. They were afraid that in the process of collapsing, the Soviet Union may try to launch a nuclear war or something in order to try to restore their power. And there was a lot of discussion about this in the 70s in particular, and coming out of intelligence estimates in the late 60s,
absolutely,
that the Soviet Union was collapsing.
I just wish the media would cover this a little more. You know, do a little research and tell the truth.
Yeah, it's, well said. Absolutely well said. This whole canard that Ronald Reagan was somehow responsible for bringing down the Soviet Union is just, it's so much beyond. Not only that, the Soviet Union actually collapsed when Jerry Ford was president. Why not give him the credit if you're going to looking for somebody to give credit to? But, Ronald Reagan, his behavior was completely non-conservative, in my opinion. Not that I would hold that up as a high ideal, but his rhetoric was conservative. And that seems to be a high value. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, is financial Armageddon on its way?
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. Well, the stock market fell several hundred points last week. It looks like this week it's kind of bouncing back a little bit. Right now the Dow is up 59 points. But there's a lot of speculation in the financial press about what all this means and whether there's a financial Armageddon coming down the road. And in fact, an interesting piece in the Financial Times we'll get into in some detail a little later on in the program about sovereign wealth funds, SWFs. This is a phrase that may be new to many of you. Note this, sovereign wealth funds. This is where countries like communist China are out there buying companies like the Blackstone Group, which are then owning companies all over the United States. Anyhow, one of the experts on this is Michael Panzer. He runs a website called financialarmageddon.com and is the author of the book, Financial Armageddon, Four Impending Catastrophes. Michael Panzer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we've got hedge funds melting down, in part because the subprime mortgage market is going in the tank, in part because credit has been so easy and so loose, and now with some small amount of deflation in the housing market as interest rates are going up, people can't afford to pay the mortgages, so we've got all these defaults. And that's now echoing into the corporate market, where corporate bonds are going up, the interest rates are going up, the requirements are getting tighter. Are we seeing an absolute crisis in liquidity here? Are we seeing the beginning of the end of easy and free and cheap money?
I think we certainly are, and the thing to remember about credit generally, it is all about confidence. It's a confidence game, and I don't mean that facetiously, but the point is once people start losing confidence, once they start thinking that they're not going to get their money back, then all of a sudden everybody starts pulling in their horns, and it really changes the nature of the game.
Yeah, I think we have to remember that when Franklin Roosevelt said
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
But that was in 1934. He was not talking about the war. He was not talking about the Nazis. He was talking about the fear of economic disaster that was just widespread in the United States as we were in the depths of the Great Depression.
Well, you know, it did take several years to get there, and I think if you read the papers over the weekend, for example, I sense a great deal of complacency, in fact. People seem to think, oh, last week was nothing but a sort of storm in a teacup, reckoning that it's all business as usual, not seeing that, across the globe, there's a problem right now, and the problem is with credit.
Yeah, and this is something that doesn't seem to get much bandwidth in the media, and I think it's probably because most people don't understand the concept of liquidity and its relationship to credit. They don't even know what the word liquidity means. And so is the stock market up or down? And that's their bottom line. And really what we're talking about here is the availability of cash. Now, that's a reasonable definition of liquidity. The Bush administration stopped publishing M3, the number of the amount of money that is being manufactured out of thin air and dumped into the American economy. Was it two years ago? A year ago, March?
Sure.
Yeah, something like that. If we're talking with Michael Panzer, financialarmageddon.com. Michael, what's your take on the significance of that they're no longer publishing M3? Are they inflating the currency much more rapidly than we're being led to believe, number one? And number two, what are the four disasters that you're talking about in your book?
Well, I think the first point you make a fair one, but the thing to remember, and unlike, say, what's going on now in Zimbabwe, where they're literally printing money, you have all this money being created that's credit money. In a sense, it's just creating more and more leverage. People are borrowing more and more money, and it's really a sort of a pyramid of debt. And that's a thing to bear in mind. But clearly, there's been some sense of trying to disguise what's been going on, but I think that's coming home to roost a little bit now. And in terms of the specifics, I mean, debt, I think, is the cornerstone of really the problems we have now and is one of the issues I cite in the book. Otherwise, we also have an issue with government guarantees. Most of you are familiar with Fannie Mae and entities like that. But there's all these sort of contingent obligations that we're on the hook for going down the road. We've also got an issue with derivatives, which I think are the proverbial match that lights the fuse, and we're seeing that already. Bear Stearns, for example, was essentially suffering to a certain extent from their exposure to an exotic form of derivative.
Right. Derivatives, tell me if you agree with this description, because we're using words here that may be unfamiliar to people.
Sure.
Derivatives are basically when you take conventional financial instruments like mortgages, for example, or stocks or bonds or whatever, and package them, bundle them, or bet in favor or against them in ways that in aggregate come up with these relatively complex financial models that are designed to maximize profit, instantaneous or short-term profit, and in some cases at the same time maximize risk, even though they're sold as minimizing risk. Is that a reasonable description of a derivative?
Well, that may even be too complicated. And essentially, they're paper promises. The difference between, say, derivatives and other securities is they always depend on something else. So if you're talking about a mortgage-backed securities, which that happens to be this synthetic self-created instrument that's really represents a bundle of mortgage loans. So it's always it's always a piece of paper that represents something else. The scary aspect is that many of these derivative securities have an element of leverage built into them. In other words, they're just another form of gearing up or of essentially operating with less money than the face value of the actual.
So it's like back in the roaring 20s when you could buy stock on a 10% margin, and so you owned $1,000 worth of stock with a $100 investment.
Yeah.
And then that $1,000 of stock dropped down to having a value of $800, and suddenly your $100 investment is wiped out, plus you owe $100, and that's, you know, the old margin call, everybody, you know, people jumping off roofs and things.
Well, that's the biggest danger, and the other issue is that a lot of these securities really require a computer, require a high-powered math, require all sorts of interesting assumptions, many of which have never been tested, and you put that all together, you have this, you know, gigantic market which has this sort of pyramid of leverage built into it, which nobody fully understands, and then all of a sudden you get a credit crunch, and it's look out below.
Right. And one of the points that Kevin Phillips makes in his most recent book about the generation of wealth in the United States is that for the first time in our 231-year history, over the last 2.5 decades, more or less, basically since the middle of the Reagan era, our economy is now generating more money, or at least the movers and shakers in our economy, are generating more money from the process of generating money than they are from the manufacture of goods or the distribution of services.
I agree, and I think, you know, arguably that's a sign of a decline in an empire where they move away from making real things to paper shuffling, and certainly there are arguments to be said for that being a sort of a marking a top, so to speak.
Yeah, I think we have. So, Michael, two quick questions in the minute and a half or 2 minutes we have left here. Number one, what can and or should individuals do about the possibility of a coming financial storm? And secondly, what should we be pushing for at the level of government policy in order to prevent this sort of a disaster from coming, or is it simply too late for that?
Well, I suppose you could make the argument it's never too late, except that if you look at history, credit-induced bubbles like we've seen always end pretty badly, and so it's hard to believe this time around will be different. Clearly a sudden turnaround, a sudden sense of prudence, a sudden sense that of responsibility, people acting like adults in Washington, that might make a
difference. But everything I'm reading about is that all kinds of pressure is being put on Bernanke to offer looser credit. To, you know, give us more of the same.
I agree, but that's the problem is people have gotten used to easy solutions. You know, whether you're talking at the government level or the individual level, people want the easy way out, and unfortunately, that usually ends badly.
So, what should individuals do?
Well, clearly they should take it seriously. I mean, you can read the press today, and everyone's saying things are quote contained. There's no problem. This is all a storm. You know, like I said, a little bit of a blip. But the reality is the ball game's changed. There's a lot of debt built up. Against all kinds of assets, which suggests that when those assets fall in price, the debt's still going to be there. But as individuals, you want to live essentially more prudently. You want to reduce debt. You want to shift into defensive sectors and into cash primarily. You want to adjust your lifestyle. You want to live a life that is appropriate to hard times.
Yeah. So it's sort of like our grandparents' generation, live within your means.
Well,
there was
nothing wrong with that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And do so prudently. Michael Panzer, his website, financialarmageddon.com, the book Financial Armageddon. Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes, it's scary talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
To confirm Ben Bernanke is the 14th chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Every breath you take, every change of rate, jobs you don't create, while we still stack fleet, I'll be watching you.
We're watching you, Ben Bernanke.
Every single day, Bernanke takes my pay. When growth goes away, inflation will stay, and I'll be watching you. Oh, can't you see the fit where I should be? A few more bips when demand then dips and the yield curve flips. I'll be watching you.
Yeah, and that yield curve was flipped for about 6 months there, and a lot of people were very concerned about that. Oh, welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Sovereign funds shake the logic of capitalism. This is just... How do you get into that? I've been really struggling with ever since I read this in the Financial Times this morning. The Financial Times of London devoted a full page to this whole issue of sovereign funds. And, I mean, there's a lot of concern about this in the financial communities around the world, and there's frankly a lot of concern about this in political communities around the world, and it is not being covered in the mainstream media at all, as far as I can tell. And this is a huge issue. And here's how it works. Imagine if Microsoft, just to pick a company, I mean, not that they're necessarily good or bad or anything, but it's a big corporation, right? One of the largest in the United States. Imagine if Microsoft, or General Motors for that matter, or General Electric, might be a better example because they own a television network. Imagine if General Electric had an army with guns and the absolute right to shoot and kill people, and they had a police force, and they could go into your city, they could go to your home, they could kick in your door and imprison you for the rest of your life. Imagine if they had that power legally granted to them by the state. The absolute confluence of political entity and economic entity. Now, this is what Mussolini referred to as fascism. The merging of corporate and state interests. And what's happened now is that globalization, the NAFTA and GATT treaties, and this really started with Reagan, most favored nation status and that sort of thing, preferred trade agreements and whatnot. But it really stepped into high gear in the presidential campaign of 1992. When you had Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush both taking the position that NAFTA and GATT would be a fine thing, and the only guy who was willing to stand up and speak the truth was that crazy old coot, Ross Perot, who turns out, in hindsight, wasn't all that crazy. And what happened is we changed the rules of the game after 200 and some odd years, 215 years or whatever it was at that point in time of this country being an independent republic. We said we are no longer going to determine the trade policy of the United States at the level of Congress. We're no longer going to determine the level of the trade policy of the United States based on what's best for the United States. Instead, we're going to turn it over to an international body, the World Trade Organization, that is run by and large of, by, and for large transnational and global corporations. They're going to make the rules. Similarly with NAFTA, Article 11 or Chapter 11, whatever it's called in NAFTA, where they actually, corporations have the right to sue states, cities, and nations, and in fact have on many occasions. So now we have a situation where as a consequence of this change in trade policy, individual states that own their economies, which is not us. Our government does not own our economy. The U.S. government does not own General Electric, does not own General Motors, and does not own Microsoft. But imagine if they did. And if our government could take all the profit from Microsoft and from GE and from General Motors and every other corporation in America, and then use that profit to buy, for example, half the companies in Germany. Or half the companies in Mexico, or three quarters of the companies in Mexico. Mexico would get very nervous, or Canada. Say our government had all that economic power and went into... Well, that's what's happened now with the United Arab Emirates. It's what's happened with Saudi Arabia. It's what's happening with China. It's what's happening with Kuwait. To a large extent, it's what's happening with Russia. The United Arab Emirates has over $500 billion in what's called a sovereign wealth fund, an SWF. and they are using it to buy this. The headline, article by Lawrence Summers, a professor at Harvard University, former economist, administration official. Lawrence Summers, writing in the Financial Times today, pointing out that there are $2.5 trillion floating around in these sovereign wealth funds, money controlled by governments that we may not like, who are coming into our country and other countries and buying up our assets. For example, China just bought the largest external stake in Blackstone, the group that we were talking about last Friday. In Qatar, they're buying Sainsbury, Britain's largest supermarket. Gazprom owns part of Airbus. Gazprom, the Russian government-owned company. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now America's waking up. America's talking back. America's telling their elected representatives, hey, guys, how about representing us for a change? Okay, let me just give you the summary on this thing. Everybody's all hysterical about Rupert Murdoch buying the Wall Street Journal. Right? I mean, the people at the Wall Street Journal are worried about it. The Wall Street seems to be worried about it. It's just a broad concern that one of the grand old journalistic institutions of the United States, even though its editorial page is filled with conservative drivel, diatribe, and venom, nonetheless, their news, their reporting is damn good. And there's a lot of concern that it's going to become Foxified. Imagine if instead of Rupert Murdoch buying the Wall Street Journal, it was the Communist Republic of China. Imagine if instead of Rupert Murdoch buying the Wall Street Journal, it was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And then we go to Saudi Arabia and we say, hey, how'd you like to join the coalition of the willing? How'd you like? We're pulling out of Iraq. We need your help here in Iraq. And they say, well, that's fine, but we'll only do it if you give a tax break to the 175 corporations in the United States that we own. Or alternatively, what if China owned, say, thousands of major corporations in the United States and said, we're going to take out Taiwan. And if you stop us, we're going to shut down these companies in the United States that we own. We'll shut down the factories, we'll move them all to Mexico tomorrow morning, and your economy will be non-existent. As Lauren Summers notes, governments are very different from other economic actors. And that's what's happening right now. $2.5 trillion floating around in these sovereign wealth funds, that is, investment funds owned by governments, not by investors. And they're estimating that that amount is going to increase, and this, again, as a consequence of these insane trade policies put into practice over the last 26 years, that's going to increase to $5 trillion by 2010 and $12 trillion by 2015. It's an absolutely mind-boggling amount of money that is out there that is coming to a city near you if it's not already there. Not good stuff. Not good stuff. Weldon in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Weldon, what's in your mind today?
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the whole hedge fund thing. I don't quite understand it, so maybe you can enlighten us a little bit more. But I heard a report the other day just saying that you know the scope of the hedge fund market is in the range of $400 trillion. and that it's totally unregulated. And I'm just wondering if that's true.
Yeah, the $400 trillion would seems very excessive to me. I would be surprised if it was anything close to that large. But, I mean, a trillion is 1,000 billion, so that's even $1 trillion is an enormous amount of money.
Well,
but, yeah, by and large, they are. And the popularity of hedge funds has come about as a result of two things. One, they, by representing themselves as an investment vehicle that is inconsistent, that is different from traditional investment vehicles that are subject to regulation, and by saying that you can only get into them if you invest at least, and I, as I recall, you had to invest at least $250,000 and you had to have a net worth of over $1 million, which meant that you were capable of taking risk, which meant that you were outside the purview of the rules that are set up to protect ordinary investors, you know, people like you and me, average investors, that hedge funds therefore were operating outside of the world of tight regulation. And they're called hedge funds because they're designed to hedge against changes in the economy, against, you know, at least in theory. And so in many cases, they're investing in very odd things like, for example, you know, puts or calls, you know, the betting that a stock is going to go up or down rather than actually buying the stock. And so you get enormous leverage. I mean, you can buy a $2 put that'll produce a $20 or $30 return if the stock goes down the way you expect. It's like it's buying on margin on steroids, because you're not actually even buying on margin. You're just promising to at some point in the future or to sell on margin. And that's, you know, just one example. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different investment vehicles that have been put into hedge funds, though, and a lot of them have been relying very heavily on credit instruments and bonds and government bonds and corporate bonds, and in particular in these aggregations of these subprime mortgage bonds, or you know, putting together as debt instruments as almost like equities, almost like a stock, there are a lot of people who are very concerned, and I'm talking about, like, you know, normal economists writing in the Wall Street Journal, that this is a bomb waiting to go off in our face.
Right.
And this was designed so that rich people could get richer faster. I mean, that's the bottom line. The hedge funds, in my opinion, were all about, you know, greed running on steroids.
Is it basically like speculating on speculation? Is that what I'm
understanding? Yeah, that would be one way to put it. I mean, you know, in some cases, I mean, some of the hedge funds are more rationally run. They just get around all the rules by saying only rich people need apply. But yeah, the problem is that they have the potential to bring down the entire economy with them, in the opinion of many economists, and they are largely unregulated, and they do represent massive amounts of money because they're, you know, a lot of very, very wealthy people in them, and the 19,000 wealthiest families in the United States now control a good chunk of our economy and of our wealth. So that's the bottom line, Weldon. Thanks for the call. Scott in San Francisco. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi. I know this isn't really on topic for what's been going on for the last half hour, but since it keeps coming up, the demise of the Soviet Union, people kept mentioning, you know, the Reagan worshippers' view of how Ronnie Spaketh and the wall came down, and the standard retort to that is, you know, well, it had been rotting from the inside for decades. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, what people should remember is just the 1991 coup, the hardliners, and Boris Yeltsin's role in upending that, and that he had the military supporting him. And, you know, for all Yeltsin's drunkenness and craziness over time, you know, he really should be more credited for bringing down the Soviet Union than he gets credit for.
Yeah, he was really the hero of the thing. Good point. And also, I misspoke hugely. I said it was Jerry Ford. It was George Herbert Walker Bush was the president who followed Reagan. And as you point out, in 91, that is when it happened. And Bush Sr. was president at the time. But the conservatives are not going to try and give him any credit at all. You know, because he raised taxes. God forbid. Scott, thanks for the call. Good point and well made. Renee in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Renee.
I hate to retrograde back to a topic earlier in your show, but I was hoping maybe you could possibly clear up something.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the petition to impeach Bush, you know, originally before this thing got started, it seemed to me that the Democrats nor anybody else wanted to get this whole thing started because they were wanting, one, not to impeach him because we were in a state of war, and two, They didn't want Cheney to become to be in power by impeaching him. So why is the agenda changing, and will this actually occur? If will Cheney get into power if we actually manage to impeach him? Why are we now jumping on this bandwagon?
Well, many of the folks now who are arguing for the impeachment, for example, Bruce Fein, the conservative who was in the Reagan administration, the guy who was the author of the articles of impeachment against Clinton, who was on this program last week. The Washington Post, or I think Progress picked up the story today because he actually talked with the Washington Post about this, but he's been on, Bill Moyers interviewed him 2 weeks ago. What he's calling for and what many people are calling for, what I'm calling for, is not the impeachment of George W. Bush, but the impeachment of Bush and Cheney at the same time simultaneously. They are both guilty of crimes against the Constitution.
Exactly. Totally agree with that.
Yeah, and that's the simple solution. And everything else that's been put forward, oh, we're a time of war, no, we're not. We're occupying another country, and it's a messy occupation, but that, it's not like fighting World War II. I'm sorry, it's just not.
Impeach them, would it also not include, they're just kind of figureheads at the same time, because it would be a long list of a whole bunch of other people who would also need to be falling down and taking the fall, not just Scooter Libby, because there's a long list of people who should also have charges brought against them for the crap and the mess that they've put us in.
Yeah, as Carlos Marcello said to Jimmy Hoffa back in 1962, if you cut off the tail of the dog, it just turns around and bites you. If you cut off its head, it falls over. If the head of this administration, Bush and Cheney, were removed from office, then all the support, all the props like Alberto Gonzalez, all the other criminal enterprises within this administration, would fall. And that's why I think impeachment of the head rather than going after the tail like Gonzalez is really the way to go. But we'll see. We'll just see how it works out. Thanks a lot for the call, Renee. Tom in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Tom, just about a half a minute here before we got to take a break.
I just basically wanted to express the fact that nobody discusses impeachment in terms of tactic rather than principle. Everybody talks about the principle. But in fact, after 8 years of the Clinton administration, which were great, and which Gore should have walked in with presidency and the Democrats should have been swept into Congress, Gore actually distanced himself and was weakened enough to fall, and the Republicans went back in, and it was primarily because Clinton was impeached.
Right, and that was the use of impeachment as a partisan tactic, not a political tactic.
Yeah. What I'm saying is the Democrats say they want to win the next election, but they don't want to use, their biggest tactic to get it.
I know. It's incredible. It's just like Kerry wanted to be president, but he didn't want to take on the Swift boat guys. It's sad.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, this is interesting. Congressman Keith Ellison, the Democrat from Minnesota, has been on this program several times. Good guy. The only Muslim in the United States Congress. And in my opinion, a truly patriotic and heroic American, particularly given the grief that he's been given for being elected as a Muslim. When he was in Iraq, he said he was given a message to convey by two sheikhs he met in Ramadi. He said they were very upset and concerned that Al-Qaeda is misrepresenting Islam. This is a story he shared with reporters during a conference call from Germany. He says, and they were talking to me about what I could possibly do to work with them to give a clearer, more accurate picture of what Islam is all about. That's interesting. Interesting story. Speaking of interesting, over the weekend in the San Francisco Chronicle, John Wildermuth, the Chronicle staff writer, writing in Saturday's paper, state-sanctioned teams of computer hackers were able to break through the security of virtually every model of California's voting machines and change results or take control of some of the system's electronic functions, according to a University of California study released Friday. Secretary of State Deborah Bowen, who was on this program, a year and a half, 2 years ago, when she was actually running for Secretary of State, she was a state senator. She said the researchers were able to bypass, and this was one of the issues that she ran on, and the reason why she was on our show. She says the researchers were able to bypass physical and software security in every machine they tested. She, by the way, is the person who had authorized this, quote, top-to-bottom review, end quote, of every voting system certified by the state. Matt Bishop, a computer science professor at the University of California, Davis, who led this hacking effort, the Red Team, he said all information available to the Secretary of State was made available to all the testers. Now, the voting machine apologists are pointing out what he just said, all the information was given to the testers. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, this stuff, if you think this stuff is secret, then, you know, you must believe that pigeons are robots or something. Anyhow, the bottom line, the review included voting equipment from every company approved for use in the state, including Sequoia, whose systems are used in Alameda, Napa and Santa Clara counties, Hart InterCivic, which is used in San Mateo and Sonoma counties, and Diebold, used in Marin County. So it's pretty startling, Deborah Bowen has to decide by Friday of this week whether or not to decertify the voting machines in the state, because that's 6 months before the February 5th vote, and, you know, they have to do it 6 months in advance. So the question, is California going to go back to paper ballots? Let's just get rid of the machines. I mean, it's done in virtually every fully industrialized, top flight, top of the, you know, country in the world. They use paper ballots. And this is not rocket science to count votes. In some countries, in Germany, I saw it happening in Germany, the vote counting is done by civil servants who would otherwise be working at the Department of Motor Vehicles on that day or, you know, in non-critical functions. And they come in and count the votes, and you get people from the political parties who are looking over their shoulders, making sure that the count is done right. And you count the paper, and you write it down on paper, and then somebody enters it into a computer, but there's an absolute paper trail, even of the paper trail. I mean, there's a long history in the United States of our doing this. We did it for over 200 years. When I was a kid, I remember going with my parents down to vote down at Kendon Elementary School in Lansing, Michigan, and seeing the local volunteers who would show up to count the votes, and along with somebody from the Secretary of State's office and the local party officials. And so it takes an extra day to get the results. If you have decent exit polls, you know what the results are anyway, or at least you know what they probably are. I am just, you know, the privatization of our vote in this country is just such a bad thing, such a tragic thing, such a wrong thing. Of all the things to privatize, I mean, okay, so they want to privatize the concession stand at Yellowstone, and they're going to bring in Pepsi or something to sell candy bars and soft drinks. I don't think it should be that way. I think the government should make the money from it and help to pay for the cost of Yellowstone. But, you know, if some right-wing crank wants to get in and say, no, private corporations should make the profit from that rather than the government from the commons of Yellowstone in terms of the concession, it's a small crime against democracy. It shouldn't be, but it's not a major felony. It's a misdemeanor against democracy. But to say that the beating heart of democracy, our vote, is going to be handed over to private, for-profit corporations accountable to nobody who are asserting privilege at the level that even George Bush can't imagine. I mean, he's running around going, I got executive privilege. You can't see what I wrote. Well, they're saying that they've got trademark privilege and patent privilege, and you can't see how their software is written. You can't see how their machines are designed. You can't see anything about what's going on inside them. It's just wrong. The privatization of the vote, of all the things that the conservatives want to corporatize in the United States. I mean, they want to corporatize. The old word was privatize. I prefer corporatize, frankly. They want to corporatize our roads. They want to corporatize our fire departments. I mean, they want to corporatize our schools. They want all of the commons. You know, increasingly, they want to corporatize our water systems, our power systems, all the things that traditionally we have said, you know, collectively, we're going to own this stuff because we don't think that, you know, some fat cat should be making the profit off this. We think that we the people, it should be run for we the people. The things that have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the United States. The ultimate, this is the commons, the things that we collectively own. The things that make us a nation, that make us a society, that make us a republic. That we collectively own these things, the wealth that we own in common, the reason why Virginia and Massachusetts and several other states, Pennsylvania, referred to as the commonwealth of, because there is a commonwealth. That's why they created the state in the first place, was to administer the wealth that was held in common. And to say that this commonwealth, all this collective wealth that is our national parks and our police departments and our education system and our military and our air and our water and in the majority of Americans get their power from public utilities and all of this stuff, that all of this stuff, which is controlled by our elected representatives, ultimately by us, because we choose them every 2 years. All of this stuff, which is owned by us and controlled by us, the commons of the United States. It's like the giant enchilada, right? It's like everything is all controlled through one little bottleneck. There is one little tiny bottleneck point that represents the very thinnest of membranes or the very smallest of bottlenecks, for lack of a better word, between us, all of us in the United States, all of us citizens, we the people of the United States of America, and our elected representatives who hold all of the commons in trust. And that bottleneck is the vote. The vote is the way that we make our will known to our elected representatives. And it's obviously not the only way. I mean, you can call them, you can write them, you can show up at the meetings, you can camp out in their office, whatever, but it is the ultimate. This is the ultimate means by which we engage in a small d democratic process in this small r republic of the United States. And our vote should be the last thing that is ever privatized, that is ever corporatized, that is ever turned over to private for-profit corporations, particularly when they assert an absolute lack of accountability to us or transparency to us. So it's going to be interesting to watch. This week, Deborah Bowen's going to have to make a decision, the Secretary of State of California, whether California's going to continue to have their vote be counted by private for-profit corporations or whether they're going to go back to doing it the way that they did it for, I don't know how long California's been a state, presumably somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 100 years, and the way it's been done in the United States for well over 200 years. Of write it down on a piece of paper here, buddy. It's very simple stuff. 16 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our number.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Indeed. Get yourself a working man's PhD. Join a union. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. If you want to participate in our blog, just click the Tom Hartman Show and it'll our program and it'll take you over to the blog there and drop in your thoughts for the day. Always interesting to read those after we get off the air and sometimes even while we're on the air. Also, if you want to drop into our live chat room, which I read during the breaks and hang out with the folks there, you'll find a link from AirAmerica.com and also at the top of TomHartman.com. Bob in Queens, New York, listening on WWRL 1600.
Hello, hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah. I called to talk about this thing you were talking about with Ronald Reagan before, but briefly, let me just say on this voting thing, that one of the best analogies I've heard is that if I go into McDonald's and buy a Big Mac, I can get a receipt for my Big Mac. Why can't I get a receipt? Or why can't there be a receipt for my vote and for when I voted and who I voted for? I mean, it doesn't have to be publicized, but it's got to be.
Yeah, but see, Bob, a receipt isn't enough. Good point, but a receipt isn't enough. We need to actually be generating the ballots. But let's get back to that in just a minute. Right now, Terry O'Sullivan is with us. He's the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the website. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks again for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us here. A number of things here in the news. This ABC, Washington Post ABC poll. You wanted to riff on this a bit.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. The storyline in the mainstream media that progressive Democrats, I think, need to rebut. As you mentioned, there's a new Washington Post ABC news poll that has the approval ratings for both the president and Congress in the basement. The president's approval rating is at 33%, which we and your listeners can understand why. The approval rating for Congress is at 37% overall. So there's a story that's getting reported that Americans are angry at both Congress and the president. I think, Tom, it's critically important to look behind the numbers. People are angry at Congress not being able to implement the agenda they were elected to put into action. And it's an old Washington trick, as you know, make it impossible to get anything done. And then say Congress is a do-nothing Congress.
Yeah, well, and the Republicans who are, you know, very much, I mean, running the Reagan meme. Here's Ronald Reagan.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
I mean, he ran on destroying the government of the United States of America. He did a fairly good job in the early stages. George W. Bush has done a marvelous job of destroying the government. And so they break FEMA, for example. And then when FEMA doesn't work, they say, hey, see, look at that. They break our schools. When our schools don't work, they say, see, look at that. Government shouldn't be doing this stuff. Let's give it over to a private corporation. Let some fat guy get rich on it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Tom, look, I think we need to, as progressive Democrats, we have to keep the anger focused in the right place.
Indeed.
46% of Americans do approve of the performance of Democrats in the Congress. 34% approve of the job the Republicans are doing. We have to remember that 2006 wasn't a presidential year. A Democratic Congress has been blocked by the president and by some Republicans or most Republicans from doing what the people elected them to do. And as progressive Democrats, as a Democratic Party, while we're not completely pleased with everything that's going on in Washington, D.C., which isn't new, I think we need to remember that 2006 was the first step of a two-step process to get this country back in the hands of progressives and working people in this country.
Yeah. We're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org, the website, LIUNA. And Terry, your colleagues in all the many other unions across the United States, some of them in the past some unions actually came out and endorsed Ronald Reagan, which was pretty shocking. Where is organized labor going to be in the 2008 election?
Well, as far as candidates, it's still up in the air, Tom. We're certainly going to be with a Democrat. I think that we have an A-list team of candidates versus our opponents, particularly this time around. Organized labor is going to be communicating with our membership about the bread and butter, the kitchen table issues that affect their livelihood. This is a fight like no other, and we in organized labor realize that. Our get out the vote and mobilization efforts are going to be absolutely second to none. Whoever the Democratic presidential nominee ends up being, I know our union, and I believe all of organized labor is going to be firmly behind them.
Yeah, well, let's Let's hope that's the case. I'm sure you're right. It's just, it is, the mask has fallen off. You know, when Reagan came into office, he held up this mask of compassion and conservatism, Bush's phrase, but Reagan was essentially promoting that. And we've all seen behind the mask now.
Yep. And I think that's why when I saw the article today and seen some other periodicals, that's why we need to keep reminding ourselves what's different about this country and this Congress. I mean, we passed the minimum wage increase, passed funding for stem cell research, new Homeland Security Commission recommendations have been passed, passed legislation to cut the cost of student loans. And this Democratic Congress is doing everything they can to change the dynamics on the war in Iraq. I mean, when you look backwards, this Congress has done 10 times more than the past Congress even thought about doing.
Right. And therefore, Bush is threatening vetoes.
That's why we need a Democrat in the White House, Tom.
There you go. And a bulletproof Democratic majority in both the House and Senate, a veto-proof majority.
Amen.
Terry O'Sullivan. Yeah. Terry O'Sullivan, General President, Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org. Thanks, Terry. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Here's the captain of the Iraqi soccer team. Just, you know, won the Asian Cup. I mean, this is a big deal. In fact, all of Iraq for a few hours came together and celebrated this thing. And then a bomb went off. But this was an extraordinary moment. And Yonas Mahmoud, the captain of the Iraqi soccer team, was asked by reporters after the game, his thoughts on what's going on in his country right now. And he said, I want America to go out today, tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, but out. I wish the American people didn't invade Iraq, and hopefully it will be over soon. He also said he's afraid to go back home to Iraq. He said, I don't want the Iraqi people to be angry with me. If I go back with the team, anybody could kill me or try to hurt me. This guy is terrified. And probably rightly so. We have created the second largest refugee crisis in the world behind Darfur. 4 million refugees in Iraq right now. 2 million of them outside the country, 2 million of them inside the country. Anywhere from 50 to 100 random murder, not random actually, in all probability, you find these bodies with the hands handcuffed behind them and a bullet hole through the head and very often drill marks all over the body. Torture. Bodies found every day all over the country. This is what George W. Bush and the conservatives in the House and Senate brought us. Absolutely tragic. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian, what's up?
How you doing? What's going on? I would like to make a comment. You know, and we hear of a do-nothing Congress.
Yeah.
And we all know what that means. They all have to get together and make it work. But I also feel like we have a do-nothing citizen because some of us are working hard every day protesting. And I wear my orange, you know, declare yourself orange with can't wait. I wear that every single day. I have a T-shirt that says impeach Bush every single day. I'm talking about what is going on in our Congress, what's going to happen to us if we lose everything, and what are we going to leave the little ones if we don't fight today. I feel if every single last one of us, at least 30% of us, 50%, go have a seat in front of Capitol Hill. And you know, these young people, the world can't wait. They can't wait. They don't want to wait. And they fight, and they fight, and they fight. But then some of us sit back and let someone else do it for us. That can't happen. It's like a union. Some people in a union, They'll go fight and fight and fight, and others sit back and reap the benefits. And I don't think it's fair.
No, I think you're very, very well said, Brian. No,
we want it, Tom. If we truly want our country back, then we all need to find a group, an organization, and join it and start speaking like we want it.
Yeah.
Because I
even without a group or organization, we need to get out there and speak out and be putting our names and ourselves in front of our elected representatives. Well said, Brian. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Hank in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Hank.
Yeah.
Hank?
Yeah. I was glad to shake your hand when you were in Grand Rapids here a week ago.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Nice to
shame
meet you.
Didn't fill Calder Square. Anyway, I was listening to your earlier hedge fund guy,
uh-huh.
and I wondered with Paulson being over in China now, what's the link to that, him trying to get them not to use euros to buy their oil and further deplete our or decrease our value of our dollar?
Wouldn't surprise me at all. Also, China has become the tail that wags the dog with regard to the U.S. economy. We were concerned back in the 70s and 80s that Japan was moving in that direction, but what China has done is something that is way beyond anything Japan ever even dreamed of. And China, at the same time, you know, Japan never had a defense minister who said that they would nuke 100 American cities if we tried to take them on over Taiwan. This is something that really should concern all of us. And now we've got, you know, a cabinet official. We've got Henry Paulson going over there, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury going over to China to basically bow and scrape. And I mean, I'm all in favor of, you know, reasonable bilateral relationships with other countries, even countries that are not necessarily our friends politically. But this is the consequence, and Paulson is one of these guys. You know, his long history in the investment community, one of those guys who in the banking community, one of those guys who represents the interests of extraordinary wealth, enormous wealth and economic power worldwide, and you know the big transnational corporations and global corporations, and so it's like. We're seeing this scenario played out right in front of us, where American sovereignty is being destroyed, the interests of American workers is being ignored, and democracy itself is being sacrificed on the altar of laissez-faire capitalism, of absolutely unregulated capitalism. And what we've seen in the past is in the other two periods when we had laissez-faire capitalism in the United States, in the 1880s to the 1900s, leading up to the Panic of 1894, as I recall, and then in from 1918 until 1929, leading to the Republican Great Depression, the other two times when we had that kind of economic policy in the United States, it destroyed our country and harmed the entire world, frankly, economically. And this time, these guys, we've been doing it for 26 years now, and they're betting the farm that it's just the damage is going to be limited to the United States and like Halliburton, they can all just move offshore. Or, you know, many of these corporations, ExxonMobil gets more than 70% of their revenue outside the United States, GE more than 50% outside the United States, on and on it goes. They're just betting that it's not going to come home to roost. And it will. It's going to hurt all of us. It's going to hurt them, too. And they can't just hide in their gated communities or move to Dubai, all of them. It's amazing. Gail in San Francisco. Hey, Gail.
Hi. I just want to make the statement that Nancy Pelosi has to understand that Cheney and Bush are laughing at her for keeping the impeachment thing off the table. She's making me crazy. I've called her at least five times. I've written her letters saying the same thing, and they don't hang up on me, but they're close to it. I just don't get it.
Yeah. I don't either, frankly, because you would think that by now they would have figured out that, particularly with that, I believe it was a Pew poll, no, it was an American Opinion Research poll that showed that more than half of the population in the United States was in favor of impeaching either Bush or Cheney. You would think that they would get it, that there is a groundswell here. I think that the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C., just like it was during the election the last four or five presidential elections where you had the Bob Shrum DLC faction running the Democratic Party, the conventional wisdom is that people like you and I represent the fringe and you know the very small percentage of Americans. And in fact, if you look at the surveys and you look at what's going on in this country, we represent the mainstream in the United States.
Absolutely.
The majority of people actually agree with the positions that we're taking on this program and that you're expressing right now. And they're just, I'm not sure who they're listening to because
they're actually laughing at this woman. They're laughing.
I know.
They know she won't do anything and they're just wreaking havoc on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I know. And it's got to be particularly difficult, you know, just in her defense, it's got to be particularly difficult for Nancy Pelosi because if Bush is impeached, then you end up with President Cheney, which would be a disaster for America because Cheney is even more toxic than Bush. If Bush and Cheney are both impeached, then Nancy Pelosi is immediately president and would presumably appoint the vice president. And if that happens, then it's not appropriate that Pelosi be the one who's leading the charge for it because there's, you know, self-interest. She would have to recuse herself. So it's got to be a really tough one for her to, you know, deal with the logistics and politics of it. But at least just stop saying it's off the table.
Yes.
Come on. I mean, it's the starting point. Gail, thank you very much for the call. It's a point well made. Ron in Sacramento, California. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about Patrick Tillman, Corporal Tillman. This three-star general, 70 times, refused to, you know, he said, well, I don't remember, I don't know, and then he took the Fifth Amendment to protect himself, right from self-incrimination. Patrick Tillman was shot at 10 yards, 3 times in the forehead. His body armor, uniform, and diary were burned within 24 hours. He contacted Noam Chomsky, apparently, in 60 minutes he was going to come out against the war in April of 2004 and support Kerry. He was against the illegal invasion of Iraq. He was put in staged firefights in Afghanistan. His doctor that had performed the autopsy said a criminal investigation needs to occur. He was denied. He went above their heads to another superiors, and they denied it. Like you said, the Bush crime family, by executive privilege, have sealed any information about that, and it would appear they didn't want a big national, internationally known celebrity coming out against the Iraq war. And so,
yeah, let's keep in mind this was right after Fallujah melted down. This was just as it was starting to look to Americans in the world like the war was really going south in a big way. The occupation was really going south in a big way, really going bad.
We need a special prosecutor for each one of these events, for Pat Tillman and for other soldiers that have probably met the same fate. Pat's just the highest profile one. And they divided up the crew. They had his brother and half the team in one space, which is a violation of standard operating procedures. They proceeded in at twilight, which, again, is another violation of standard operating procedures. I mean,
and there's no evidence of any hostile fire anywhere.
No,
military was not even their vehicles were shot at. I mean, it's absolutely off the wall. Ron, excellent summary. Thank you very much. An excellent summary of the talking points of the issue of Pat Tillman. And the question, why does George W. Bush want to hide from the American people what he knew and when he knew it? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Acid rain is not a problem, said a businessman. But all the fish are belly up and floating round. And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown. On the corner are some activists with picket signs. They want the factories to stop their filthy ways. But the government says it's okay. It'll go away any day. Acid rain is up my nose and in my eyes. Poison fish polluted skies. It makes my flowers die. Acid rain.
9 minutes before the hour. Well, the army is now up to $40,000. $40,000 in bonuses to join up. And with an additional 20,000, well, actually the additional 20 brings it up to 40. They've got this new quick shipper bonus. Additional 20,000 bucks if you join and agree to be shipped out within 30 days. Boom. Off you go. 20 bucks across your palm. And you hope and pray that you don't come back in a casket. This is how bad it is. Thomas Jefferson wrote about hoping that we would never see a time in the United States when our young men would be willing to be shot at for a sixpence. Talking about the evils of what he referred to as a mercenary army, an all-volunteer army. He believed, the two words are not synonymous, but he was conflating them, because Jefferson believed that we should have every single, at that time, and consider the times, it was 200 years ago, that every single man between the ages of 17 and 47 should have a gun in their closet and should know how to use it and should be a member of a local militia that was responsible to local authorities, who were responsible to county authorities, who were responsible to state authorities, who ultimately were responsible to the president. And in time of national emergency, the church bells would be rung a particular way, and everybody would grab their gun and step out in front of their house, and the entire nation would become the army. But the idea of having a standing army during a time of peace, he thought, was anathema to democracy. And, in fact, James Madison took it even a step farther and said if we had standing armies during times of peace, it would lead to mischief by presidents, like creating wars. And then he went on to point out that in a state of perpetual war, democracy can't exist. And Bush has declared a state of perpetual war. Jim in Mayes, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yes, I enjoy your program very much, Mr. Hartman. And I had one comment that I wanted to make about elections. And I would hope you and other progressive radio hosts would push the idea that voting should be limited to 500 people per precinct. And that would eliminate the lines that we have and the fact that so many people cannot get to vote, which is the only vestige of freedom that we seem to have left, and that's been corrupted. And I'd like your thoughts about that.
I think that's not unreasonable. I'm not sure 500 would be the proper cutoff. I'm not sure what would be, you know, maybe 1,000, maybe 800. I don't know. It would take some you know, analysis, but I think your point is really well made. Any precinct that's so large that you end up with a 10-hour line is a precinct that should be broken up into several pieces. Although, you know, the flip side of that is any precinct where you have a 10 or 12 hour wait is a precinct that's being run by a Republican system in probably an inner city or an area that's largely Democratic in the way it votes. And so, you know, it's like they're going to figure out a way to rig things no matter what. And, you know, as Mark Crispin Miller so brilliantly points out in his book, Fooled Again, the major instruments of the theft of the elections in 2000 and 2004 were not, you know, flipping votes on electronic voting machines, although there is some evidence of that, some substantial evidence of that in several states. The major elements were voter disenfranchisement. We're denying people the right to vote because they've been caged. We're giving people placebo ballots because they've been caged. We're having people stand in line for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours when they really needed to get to work and they were, you know, they had signed up for a, you know, let me stand in line for an hour and I'll vote, but they couldn't take the entire day off. But you're right. And it's interesting. I was just riffing about Jefferson. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Just riffing about Jefferson. He spoke at length in his letters and his diary about the ward system in the United States, how power needs to devolve down to the lowest and smallest level of local government, and how wards need to be empowered. I mean, literally, like, at the level of the neighborhood, that's where political power needs to rest in the United States. I thought it was really well said. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan.
Hi. If corporations are supposedly people, then why can't they be the same standing investigate them as people?
Well, first of all, they're not people, they're persons, and there's a difference.
Are persons.
But yeah. To some extent, corporations are investigated as corporate persons. You mean, like, held to account for criminal crimes and things. The problem is, I write about this in my book, Unequal Protection. And in fact, there's a whole chapter about, you know, corporations that commit murder and are not, you know, in states that have the death penalty, and they're not held to account on those on that basis. In fact, even the corporate death penalty, which is simply dissolution of the corporation, isn't enforced. Whereas prior to the 1880s, on average, a couple thousand corporations a year were given the corporate death penalty in the United States. I mean, every year, going all the way back to the founding of this country. And, well, things have changed. I mean, that's the bottom line. Things have changed in part because of the 1886 Santa Clara County decision, or the headnote attached to it, actually, not the decision, in part because of groups like the Federalist Society and, you know, the corporate lobbies and whatnot. I mean, it's just things have changed, and it ain't pretty, unfortunately. We're seeing the rise of corporate dominance and the theft of human rights is the subtitle of my book, Unequal Protection. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Michael Chapman and I are going to debate the impact of the minimum wage on the economy, particularly on small business. I'll be doing an in-depth conversation with activist Tom Hayden about the future of activism and his thoughts on Iraq and his new book on the topic. Plus, as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. We all have to become activists. We're going to save this country. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.